Why are they shaking their head? We're stuck in slow life. Is it the beating of the chest that makes us feel the rest? Good day, everyone. This is March Twisdale, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, and I'd like to welcome you to my interview, my second interview, with Daniel Offrey. Daniel, thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thanks. It's a pleasure to be back.
I know, right? And all of us get to enjoy the lovely ambiance of New York in the background, so you'll be hearing sirens and things. Aren't you really close to the hospital right now?
I live on what's called Bedpan Alley. We have about four hospitals about a half block away, so always good sirens nearby.
Got it. All righty, okie doke. So Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is recorded in the studios of Voice of Vashon, broadcast on 101.9 FM KVSH. You can learn more about the show at voiceofvashon.org or visit my website, marchtwisdale.com. I have a podcast set up now, so it's really easy to hear the show. Okie doke, so before we dive into the show, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that the views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the board, staff, underwriters, or donors of Voice of Vashon. As an organization, VOV does not take political positions. We do support our show hosts and their guests in expressing their views as long as they're not obscene or hate-mongering. So thank you, everyone, for listening. Let's see, Danielle, could you go ahead and, to get us started, just frame for our listeners sort of who you are and what you do?
Sure. So I'm a general primary care internist, and I work in a medical clinic at Bellevue Hospital, which is the oldest hospital in the United States. It's been serving New Yorkers since 1736. And I work in the clinic, so I see patients, you know, adults of all, every walk of life. On the side, I am a writer. I've written some books about doctor-patient relationship and communication, emotions. I'm also an editor, and I edit the Bellevue Literary Review, which is the first literary journal from a hospital medical setting that publishes poetry, fiction, and nonfiction about health and healing. And of late, I've been, you know, getting involved in the political arena about the Senate plans to try and appeal the Affordable Care Act.
Right, okie doke. So folks, this is going to be a juicy, fun, and probably extremely important interview. I do once again want to recommend, if you can only listen to the beginning of the show, just come back to marchtwisdale.com, go to the podcast tab at the top, and you can pick up the rest of the show later. Everyone in the world is affected by access to or lack of access to medical care, and everyone in America is very aware that we have some problems in our system. What I'd like to start off with then is this really exciting thing I think you've been working on. I don't know how long you've been working in the background, but you've been pretty active in the public realm for a number of months, I think, on helping medical professionals do something they don't typically do a lot of, which is to step out and into the political public arena a bit on this issue. Why don't you tell us how you sort of came to realize you wanted to do this work?
Well, typically, doctors and nurses, we don't do much in the way of politics. We really pride ourselves on being very neutral, keeping our exam rooms as a safe, neutral space for our patients. But we do a lot of patient advocacy. So, for example, if a patient's medication gets denied by insurance, we get on the phone and we argue with the insurance company because they can't get their care if they can't get their medication, or they can't get an appointment with a cardiologist. We get on the phone and you know, figure that out. And so I was watching the healthcare debate and realized that if the Senate healthcare plan went through, or initially this was from the House, that 40 or 23 million patients would lose health insurance across America, and some of them could probably be mine. And what would happen if my patients lost their health insurance? All the medical care I could give them wouldn't be of any value if they couldn't get their medications or couldn't come to the doctor. So it dawned on me that I need to be doing political advocacy in the same way I'd call the drug company or the insurance company about medications. So I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times in the middle of June, basically encouraging doctors and nurses to not be shy to speak up, that advocating for our patients in a nonpartisan way is very important. You know, our senators don't have much experience with healthcare. They, you know, very few are doctors, and I think that we in the medical profession, we know what goes on, and you know, every day in healthcare, so we should, you know, offer our advice to our elected representatives. Now, the thing about op-eds when you write them is that you don't get to choose the title. That's what the editors do.
Yes.
So the editors chose the title, Time for Doctors March on Washington. So I open the paper on Friday morning, and I see this title. Whew, that's not what I was saying, but sounds interesting. And I got flooded with mail saying, so when's the march? I want to come. And then, you know, I realized, boy, should we be making a march? And, of course, that's, you know, more than you could possibly do, and the vote was going to be in a week. But we decided that we could do kind of a virtual march, and we started what we call the House Calls campaign. You know, house calls are a tradition dating back hundreds of years when medical professionals go to someone's home to give them medical care.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to make virtual house calls to our senators and representatives to give them our medical opinion on how this legislation will affect our patients. And so that's how it began. We've been doing this for about a month. And as of last night, the Senate health care bill, the replacement for the Affordable Care Act, has collapsed. Two more Republican senators pulled out their votes, and now they're too many votes short to bring it up for a vote. So that, at least for now, is off the table. There has been talk of trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act without any replacement and to try and maybe figure that out down the line. But at least three senators have come out against that, saying it's too risky because who knows what will happen. You know, it could be a lot of damage. I mean, some 30 million Americans got health insurance from the Affordable Care Act, and they would stand to lose that. So that may be off the table as well, but again, you never know. So we're trying to keep up our campaign of calling senators and representatives and letting them know how these various bills and repeals would affect our patients.
So what I really love about that is that you're sort of saying, here are the things that are being proposed in Washington, D.C., and here is our feeling about what the fallout would be of these choices. Is there also an effort, and this is probably actually much more challenging, it's just like everyone feels so nervous when they even think of the idea of actually proposing what they think would work or the new idea to go for. A lot of times people will react to what's on the table, but putting something on the table can be a little scary. I'm wondering if you are aware of any sort of efforts within the world of medicine where people are generating, you know, this is the great idea to advocate on behalf of.
Well, there's been a lot of talk now about the single payer plan. You know, it used to be a toxic topic. You know, it smacks of socialized medicine. It was really the third rail. But lately, as people look at the situation and recognize that it makes a difference when we're, if we're all in the insurance pool, then costs go down because you get to balance risk between healthy patients and sick patients, right? They cost different amounts. And you get to, you know, negotiate drug prices because you're, you know, one large company. And also the recognition that Medicare and Medicaid have worked very well, and they're essentially single payer plans, so is the VA. And many people are saying, why can't we just expand that to everyone? So there's much more support for single payer plan than there has been in the past. It hasn't fully been articulated how this would be, but I think that people are starting to view that as a true possibility that should at least be discussed and examined.
Right. So what does it feel like when you're, I mean, I grew up in a medical family. So I spent my summers going to, you know, out camping with all the nurses for their summer trips. And I would go in with my mother to the hospital in the evening, like 4 or 5 nights a week, because she worked nights. And then I would hang out for about an hour or so until around 11 or midnight when my stepfather would get off of work and then he would bring me home. So I've been in a lot of those back lunch rooms and staff rooms and whatnot. And I'm curious, within various, you know, in hospitals and stuff, when people are sitting around and they're all a bunch of doctors at the table chatting, what is the sort of energy like right now with what's going on? Is there a change from 2 years ago, let's say?
What I think has really changed from 2 years ago is that there's a recognition, I think this is amongst the general population, that healthcare is really a right and not privilege, something you can buy or sell like any other commodity. And that idea has really gained currency. And I think even for doctors who didn't really think so much about it, you just take care of whoever shows up at the door. But the idea that it's really a right for everyone, the same way that, you know, fire protection, police protection, you call 911, they don't ask you, do you have coverage or not? And
that's a
I think
great
we need
point.
To accept that it, you know, it is in the same, you know, category as 911 and medical and fire. If the fire department comes, they put out the fire no matter who it is, because if you don't put out the fire, it could burn the next house. If you don't take care of someone now, they'll end up sicker, and that will cost us more anyway. We're all really in this together. Or they have an infectious disease that will spread. Or they can't take care of their children. We'll be faced with that consequence. So there really is the idea that there is a common good and that it matters, not just that I have health care coverage, but that my neighbors do too, and that affects me as well. So that recognition feels different than just a few years ago from both patients and doctors.
Well, so, okay, brilliant. Thank you so much for sort of sharing that on the other side of the doctor's desk type of perspective. I'm curious if we can go back for a second, because so, like, even for myself, I was on a research trip in Europe for a month, and I disconnected during that time so I could really focus on what I was doing. And so much is happening so quickly in the U.S., it's easy to fall behind. So if you could just for a minute sort of like break down for people who maybe who have just been like turning their face away and just groaning because they just can't handle it all, what exactly are sort of the pieces we're talking about right now? There's, you know, it sounds like there's Obamacare, and then there's this healthcare plan option that was proposed. And then, you know, what are the little pieces
sure.
of the puzzle we're talking about?
Okay, so the basic pieces, we start with what's called the Affordable Care Act, ACA, or now known as Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the law that was passed a few years ago that made the idea that everyone has to have health insurance, because that way, when you could spread the risk between healthy and sick patients, you can make the markets function. And that works by individual mandate. Everyone has to get health insurance, subsidies for those who can't afford it so they can all get it, and then also basic minimum standards for good insurance. So you couldn't sell, you know, junky insurance. It doesn't really cover anything.
Mm-hmm.
And you must cover primary care and screening. So that's been the law now for a couple of years. And, again, the rate of the uninsured has fallen drastically from about 45 million to about 15 million. So about 30 million more patients, more Americans have health insurance. Okay. So the Republicans have been trying to repeal the ACA or Obamacare, and now that they're in power, they put forth two different plans. The first was in the House of Representatives called the American Health Care Act, or the AHCA. Initially, it failed, and then in the end, it was passed. So then it goes to the Senate. Now, the Senate decided to make its own bill, called the BCRA, the Better Care Reconciliation Act, and that's the legislation that's been in the news these last few weeks, and as of last night, that bill collapsed because enough Republican senators defected, saying they wouldn't vote on it, to collapse it. Now, interestingly, those who chose to vote against it from the Republican side are doing so for opposite reasons. A few were saying, I won't vote because it's going to harm, you know, my constituents. Their health care will be harmed. You were saying it doesn't go far enough to basically cut costs and you know, cut back the requirements of the Obamacare. So really from two ends, but together they managed to sink the act. And now Plan C, the third step, is to just repeal Obamacare with nothing in its place, with the idea that we'll figure this out at some point.
So that idea would be I don't think that's probably going to happen, but I just want to make sure I'm clear. If the ACA, Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, was repealed with nothing in its place, does that mean that the repeal sets a date for when the ACA would go defunct and that gives them a period of time to work on a replacement? Or does it literally mean like the same thing that happened back in January when there was a sudden ban on people traveling from other countries to America and there's all this chaos? Would it just be like an overnight change? And
well, it sounds like they were giving a two-year date. So there's 2 years to figure it out.
Oh, okay.
The problem is that health insurance companies have to decide how much they charge for a premium. And
mm-hmm.
if you repeal the individual mandate, which in essence forces people who are healthy to also have insurance, that means you'll only have sick people have insurance, so the costs will go up.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 years is fairly short for insurance companies, so that will be a fairly abrupt rise in the cost of coverage. So people may find that their own policies will go up. Some people even say they might double, you know, within a year or two, which could make it, in essence, unaffordable.
Okay, so
if your costs double.
Right. So one of the things that bothered me about the ACA, and I am an advocate for healthcare as a right for everyone in a civil society and for actually using our tax base to fund this program for everyone. So that's where I come from. I have the impression that Obama and others were aiming for something like that, felt they couldn't get it, and the ACA was sort of what they settled for. What concerned me about the ACA was that essentially it said if you are an American citizen, you are now obligated by law to become a consumer of the insurance industry and to purchase an insurance product. And as a
but now, do you have a car?
Yes, I do. But if I chose to not have a car, I could choose to not have car insurance.
Right. But if a car, in essence, unless you live in New York City, you really most places you must have a car. Most places in America you can't. I don't have a car, so but most people need a car, and so if you're going to drive on the road, you have to have insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get sick, you know, and you can't pay, what will happen? Should you be allowed to die in the street? Okay, you don't have, you know, if you can't afford it, should society pay for your care if you can't afford it, if you got hit by a car?
Yes, I think society should pay for everyone's care.
But I agree, too. I think we can't let people, right, you know, die in the street. But if a person expects society to pay for their care if they need it, mm-hmm. then they have an obligation to pay something, you know, to do something. In this case, it would be buy insurance. Now, obviously, because we've chosen as a country to have a privatized market, you're right. We're now delivering ourselves into the hands of a commercial investment.
Right.
Because the goal of an insurance company is not to make you healthy, it's to earn money.
Right.
So ideally, it would force you to buy a plan that's a not-for-profit plan, that's just there to keep you healthy. But we don't have that in this country, and that was not politically feasible. I mean, if you remember,
right.
They tried to make a public option that would allow people to buy a non-profit insurance to compete with the profits, but that didn't make it because
right.
that would have sunk the bill. Sadly, I think the public option might have demonstrated how well you could do if profit motive comes out of there.
Yeah, if we
but
actually allowed...
But the second best alternative was that you have to buy health insurance the way you have to buy car insurance.
Yes, but aside from the defense for the ACA, my point was that for myself as a person who would like to go even farther, it was a concern that part of being an American citizen would be an obligation to purchase a commercially provided, you know, for-profit insurance product. And so what I'm hearing is that it may be that the backlash that's coming, because you brought up that you have people who are healthy who would opt out of the system if they could opt out and choose to not have insurance because they would feel or believe that they don't need it, which is probably not true because eventually you won't be healthy. But I think that that requirement that people have to buy an insurance product seems to have generated a backlash from people who are feeling frustrated or those who felt that what I've heard from people who are in that interesting economic zone where you're wealthy enough to have to, you don't have insurance already, but you can't get subsidized. And so a lot of people found that their insurance would double. And so I've known people over the last few years who will say, well, as soon as ACA went in, my insurance cost for my family of four went from, you know, $1,200 a month to $2,600 a month, and now I'm really struggling. So it seems like there were just some flaws in ACA that may have created some hardship in some places, leading to a backlash, and that hopefully if we can maybe adjust in the direction towards single payer, we can actually avoid the negatives of both directions and come to a positive center place. What do you think about that?
I wholeheartedly agree. I think that the single payer is the way to go. But I also recognize that would take a very long time to happen. I don't see it happening in the near future
mm-hmm.
because of the political realities of our country.
Right.
However, there are many things that can be fixed in the Affordable Care Act. And one of the things is to set the subsidy rate higher, that more people, for people who fall in that middle zone, they actually deserve a subsidy as well, and or a public option. So what if those people who had their insurance bill double from a private insurer could have the option to buy into a form of Medicare or Medicaid that was cheaper, but, you know, funded by the government? So those are all possible ways the Affordable Care Act could be tweaked. I mean, Care Act is a compromise to work in our crazy American healthcare system.
Right.
We're the only country that has this crazy system of health insurance from your employer or from private, you know, markets.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the, you know, the awkward compromise that had to be done. So One thought is to fix those problems. I mean, any legislation of that size, you find out things after, once you get it going,
right,
that need to be tweaked. And so far, you know, the Congress has not been able to do that. But if they could, you know, these could be fixed. They seem fixable. They don't seem out of the realm of possibility.
Right. So two thoughts right here percolating in my brain are, one of them is that when you mentioned the idea of creating that public option, essentially it would be as if we said, hey, folks, for those of you who think that the government's doing a good job over here with Medicare and you would love to enroll in this system, we're going to go ahead and allow you, no matter what age you are, to make the choice to enroll over here. And this is where you can be served. Or if you want to stay over there in the privately run, funded, and organized insurance world, then you can do that through this other side of the ACA. So is that what you're saying, that initially there was the idea of creating two?
Wonderful. And that should work. I mean, as the Republicans have talked about giving Americans more choice, I agree. Why not have the choice for a public option? What I don't agree with is having a choice to buy plans that really don't do a good job.
Right.
To buy plans that don't cover primary care, maternity care, and mental health, that's not really giving someone a choice. That's really just cheating people.
Yeah. So the public option, in a way, would have allowed people to vote with their dollar.
Right. Well, interesting to see. I think many people, if given the option, would choose Medicare or Medicaid. I mean, I have many patients with Medicaid, and it works very well.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine, maybe just about a week or two ago, that polled both the doctors and patients, and people are very satisfied with Medicaid. Most think it works wonderfully and wouldn't change. So it's not the terrible system, I think, to expand Medicaid or Medicare or the VA system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to more Americans, let Americans vote with their feet.
Essentially, when it comes to healthcare, when you have a single payer or when you have a tax-funded system like they have in many of the countries where I've been interviewing people for the past few months, in Northern Europe and Japan, other places, is that you simply have everything minus the profit layer. And then you come over to America and we've got this thick whipped cream layer of profit making in the middle of our two pieces of cake with frosting on top. And so the cost of healthcare goes up because there's this inserted profit layer. And so in a way, I feel like we need to be a bit compassionate and say, let's identify the American citizens out there who are working within that profit layer. You know, who are the people who sell insurance? Who are the people who somehow their career, their life, their child's college is going to be funded by that profit layer? It's like in Oregon, if you wanted the people who were cutting down the trees and the forestry industry to start preserving the old growth forests and not cut them down, you really needed to offer them the option to go back to college to get a degree in a new area if someone's 47 and all they've spent their life doing is being a professional at cutting down trees. They need help in adjusting to a new field of work. So has there been any sort of attention to the fairness or question of, okay, if we want to eliminate this source of profit in America, which is profit off of healthcare and off of illness, which is what pharmaceuticals are about as well, then how are we going to help those people and support them in shifting to a different field of work? Has there been any attention to that?
I have not heard that, partly because I don't think anyone realistically sees us moving toward an area or a time without the profit in healthcare, at least not now. But if, as you suggest, that maybe there's both systems coexist, a public and a private, it wouldn't disappear overnight. It may shrink.
Right.
Maybe at a rate in which you could, you know, logistically retrain people for other fields, as you do in other industries that change over time. But you're right. We have to be compassionate, you know, to people who lose their jobs as well. But I think, one thing that I've wanted to add to what you were saying about
Yeah.
the profit thing that's different here, if you look at the outcomes, our quality of care is actually much worse
Right.
than those other countries that spend much less.
It's
And
true.
that, to me, is the most painful thing. When I look at these reports that come out every year, the U.S. ranks at the bottom of all the developed countries on
Yeah.
average for things like, maternal mortality rates,
I know.
perinatal, really basic things, vaccination rates, very simple, simple things, we are falling behind. I mean, if with our profit, oriented system, we were at the top of the pack for quality, that's a different story. But we're not. So this money is going toward CEOs of healthcare companies, to
Yeah.
their stockholders, and not to the NIH for research. So I think there's lots of things we could do. And that, to me, just feels unethical that we're profiting on that. I mean, I had an issue
Right,
today
if
with a
you're
clinic.
profiting off a system that is the best, that's one thing, but you're profiting off a system that's delivering the worst outcomes.
Because it's there for money. And when you try to do the right thing, today I had a patient who had a small mass on her forehead, and I wanted to see what it was. And the least invasive, least expensive test is an ultrasound. But I wasn't able to obtain it. And when I tried to, in our hospital elsewhere, she didn't have insurance. And so in the end, I would have to order a CAT scan or an MRI that was much more expensive because I couldn't get the ultrasound covered with someone who wasn't uninsured. It was a crazy thing. And I realized, this times a million cases where I, as a practitioner, had to do a more expensive thing because the better, simpler, cheaper thing wasn't available because of insurance rules.
Right. Oh, yeah, insurance rules definitely. Obviously, the fact that one of the great things about the ACA was getting rid of what was that? What were all those problems like if you already had a
Pre-existing
pre? Yeah,
conditions.
I mean, the fact that they were doing that. It was illustrative of the higher interest in profit, less interest in health, you
Exactly. And
know?
the other thing is that I spent an hour trying to figure out this ultrasound, MRI, CT, and a full hour of a doctor's time that I couldn't be doing other patient care, just arguing on the phone with different people and dialing back and forth. It was
Yeah.
such a waste of resources. I could have, seen several patients in that time and delivered better medical care.
Right.
So we have this inefficiency built in that is so hard to fix.
There we go. Good. I was waiting for a pause so I could clear
Okay.
my throat.
Time to shift gears.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to close out this part of the interview just with
Okay.
a reminder to listeners out there that I do have another show called Focus On. You can also find that at marchtwisdale.com at the top of my website where the podcast tab is. And Focus On is where I interview people from successful socialist democracies, essentially, in the
Okay.
EU. And I talk to them about all sorts of different things. I mean, just basically, what is their take on all sorts of issues of people living together? And of course, the medical question pops up in every conversation I have with any person, whether they're on the show with me or not, because they're all so amazed and shocked at what's going on in America for millions, tens, hundreds of millions, I guess, are in the EU. For hundreds of millions of people, the idea of not being able to go to the doctor is just something that they don't quite really understand how we're willing to accept that as normal. And so I was in the hospital for 3 days, cellulitis, IV antibiotics, basically. And I was talking to a lawyer in Iceland. And she said, "Well, what's that going to cost you?" And I said to her, "Well, I'm extremely lucky. My husband works for a corporation that has, it's actually Nokia, which is from Finland, but he works for a corporation with very good health care insurance. And so it'll be probably about $15,000 for the 3 days, and I will end up paying about $1,500." And like she practically fell out of her chair. She couldn't believe it. And here I am thinking that I'm one of the really the lucky ones, which sometimes makes me feel guilty, actually. And I said, "Well, what would you pay for, 3 days in the hospital?" And she said, "I don't know, maybe $45." I mean, she said, "How are you going to pay for that?" She was shocked. And I said, "My credit card's going to pay for it, and I'll eventually figure out how to pay that off." And just she's staring at me. So we really, really, really are sort of the oddballs out, and that proves that we can do better. It's being done elsewhere. We can also do better. So, Danielle, for a second, I'm going to pause to remind our listeners that they are listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on 101.9 FM KVSH. And all of our programming is supported by wonderful, generous contributors to Voice of Vashon, including Rain's Signs. For over 27 years, Rain's Signs has produced some of Vashon's most recognizable landmarks. Rain prides herself in art directing the work to reflect Vashon and the customer's unique character. You can reach her at 206-463-2607. Also, support for this program comes from Vashon Community Care Foundation. Financial support for Vashon Community Care has been providing senior living choices for island residents since 1995, now including rehab services. You can reach them at 206-567-4421. So we're going to go ahead and shift a little bit over to a discussion of your most recent book, and I really appreciate your work and whatever it is that goes on inside your brain that allows you to literally raise beautiful children, write books, be a doctor. I mean, you are one of my shiny examples of people who obviously organize their time really well. So, the book we're looking at right now is What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. Last interview, we were talking about sort of the opposite angle, which, well, not really opposite, but what doctors feel, how emotions affect the practice of medicine. And now we're talking about communication. Tell us what your goals are for this book.
Well, one thing that I realized, both in my own experience over these years of practicing medicine and my research in the field, is that the doctor-patient conversation, which we usually think of as like, you know, bedside manner, a nice affable aside, is in fact the most powerful tool in medicine. Certainly the most powerful diagnostic tool, and often a very powerful therapeutic or treatment tool. Yet we don't give it much due. You know, we spend a lot of time thinking about what blood tests we'll get or CTs or MRIs or specialties, and we don't give much attention, either patients or doctors, to the part where we actually talk. And I want to refocus that to the, you know, center or the top of the pyramid as the most important part of medical care.
And I'm assuming that there's probably others in the world of medicine who share your viewpoint that this may be hopefully a growing area of interest.
I think so. I think the research is beginning to show that both for treatment outcomes and for cost effectiveness, that the way we communicate can be very have very, very powerful. I'll share with you just one small study done back in the 60s, but there are patients who are getting abdominal surgery, and as you might know, one of the biggest problems is post-operative pain. It's very painful when you wake up the next day, and patients need strong medications like narcotics to relieve the pain. Of course, narcotics have many bad side effects: nausea, constipation, addiction, respiratory suppression, even death. So minimizing narcotic use is a very high priority in medicine. So in this study, the night before surgery, every patient had the anesthetist come talk to them about the surgery. But for half the patients, randomly selected, they added in a 20-minute conversation about post-op pain. Very simple stuff: what the pain is, how it's caused by muscle, clenching the muscles, when you might expect it, where it will be, how long it'll last. Here are some relaxation exercises to try and relieve the pain. If that doesn't work, here's how to call the nurse. You know, nothing revolutionary. The next day, the surgeon operated. They didn't know which patient was in which group. Now, we can all probably guess that the patients who had the conversation needed less pain meds, but in fact, they needed 50% less medication, about half, which is a huge, valuable outcome. But moreover, they were discharged from the hospital 3 days earlier. Now, you just talked a little bit about hospital costs. 3 days of
Right.
hospitalization, that's probably $15,000 to $20,000 saved from a 20-minute conversation. So you can see that good communication can both improve outcomes, right? Less pain meds, quick discharge, but also save a lot of money. So if we put a little energy and focus on the communication, we can really benefit patients.
Right. You know, that is, so for example, my son, when he got his four wisdom teeth taken out, you know, he's lucky, you know, he's got a dental surgeon that he trusts that he had been with once before, who and I would be there in the room to make sure all questions were answered. And you know, we discuss, I'm a discusser, so we discuss everything, right? You know, and I was very clear. I said, I don't want you to give him any Tylenol with codeine special pills or some, no extra meds. We're just gonna, you know, take him home and have him on maybe normal ibuprofen if he needs it, ice, whatever. And he was fine. And but he would tell me sometimes stories about his friends who didn't perhaps have the same type of general support of understanding what was going on, and who would end up coming home with literally, what are those oxytocin type of pills or something, because they and then they would like use all these pills because they were so scared it was going to hurt. And I just remember being really surprised at the different outcome that came just sort of from that, even something as minor as wisdom teeth removal.
Sure, and I think certainly the area of pain is an important one where the conversation not only can be helpful diagnostically, but you know, with treatment. There's another short study I can tell you about that has to do with back pain, which is probably the single most common reason people go to their doctor these
Right.
days. And I usually send my patients for physical therapy, and because and I think about they'll get exercises and maybe massage, maybe ultrasound, or they'll get these electrical stimulation machines. But I don't often think about how the physical therapist communicates. In a very clever study, some Canadian researchers took 200 patients with back pain and sent them to physical therapists to get the electrical stimulation machine. Now, for half the patients, the machine wasn't even turned on. It was just sham. And those patients, interestingly, had 25% lower pain scores by the end of the session with nothing doing at all. So placebo, it works. But the machine was better. They turned on the machine. They had a 45% reduction in their pain. But then they further subdivide the therapist. Some were told to be silent, and the other half were told to actively engage the patients, ask about their pain, be empathetic, be optimistic that the pain would get relieved, be compassionate, make a connection. Now, so one quarter of the patients had the very actively engaged therapist, but no machine at all, and they had a 55% reduction in pain, right? So just the therapist talking was more powerful than the machine, which probably cost, you know, $20,000. But the patients who had both the machine and the physical therapist who were engaged had a 75% reduction in pain. So you can see the way that we communicate can really have amazing clinical outcomes and help patients feel better. I mean, one of my patients said, you know, I don't care if it's a friggin' dill pickle. If it relieves my pain, I'm happy to have it. So even if it's placebo or conversation, this is of value.
I love that. You know, and of course, ultimately, in so many ways, it can be said that pain, I believe pain sort of originates in the brain. The nerves of the body can pick up, they pick up communication of what's going on, but it's the brain that perceives what those neurons are telling it, right? So, I mean, we can stress ourselves out with our imagination. We can calm ourselves down with our imagination. We can do so much with our brain. So it does seem a little bit odd that we would have ever forgotten the power of
Right, and if you
thought.
look at, you know, before we had medications that actually did anything, you know, 200 years ago, probably the first time anything that did anything, what did witch doctors, you know, shamans, healers of all sorts, what did they do? A lot of it was the communication skills, and in many cases, it was remarkably effective. Patients got better either on their own or because of the communication. Now, there's probably a physiologic basis for placebo. We know that placebo can affect our natural endorphins. It can lower adrenaline and cortisol levels. And when you do MRIs, fMRI, functional MRI studies of patients getting pain relief, whether they get pain relief from a medication or from placebo, the same part of the brain lights up.
Oh, that's really, really fascinating. Oh, okay, I can see like 3 or 4 years from now, that's like the next book, right?
Right. Well, that's really interesting. And again, if you can relieve someone's pain with a conversation, you save them the side effects of the medication, the costs, the drug interactions. And for the patient, feeling better is all they care about. They don't, I think, ultimately care if it comes from a machine or a medication or your mouth. They just want to get better. So let's use the least invasive, least toxic way of getting better, And so let's take advantage of what we can do with our conversation.
Right. Obviously, we're living in a country that has underestimated the negative side effects of drug painkillers. I mean, that's why we have, oxytocin leading people into heroin addiction. And there is, it is interesting. I think when you just say, I can't do it on my own, but this pill is going to save me. We want to believe the pill is so great. We want to ignore that entire sheet of paper full of fine print talking about all the potential negatives. One of the reasons I didn't want my son to have any type of special pain medication was because when I was 18 and had my wisdom teeth taken out, they gave me something like that. It made me sick and I threw up. I guarantee you, throwing up when you have your wisdom teeth taken out is way worse than just enduring the pain of having the wisdom teeth taken out. So I was protecting my son from that potentiality, you know? Yeah. So back to conversation. So a couple of chapters in here, folks, for the, remember your relationship with your doctor matters so much because you matter so much and you're going to go home with your body and you're going to go home with your outcome. And so it's hugely important. If you're interested in this book, the title is What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. So think about that for a minute, how you think you're communicating clearly, but it may be that the doctor's hearing something slightly different. And how can we clarify that communication? This is by Danielle with two L's, Ofri, Ofri. And I'm assuming they can, go online and find this book all over the web.
So my website is danielleofri.com, and I keep all the information about my books, including reading group guides, study guides, as well as all the articles I publish, both about doctor-patient connection, emotions, communication, and also about the very side of medicine, how we use humanities and arts in the teaching of medicine and medical practice.
All right, awesome. So, like some of the chapters in here, I mean, I really like your titles. They're actually very unique and humorous, like communication and its discontents. So, one of the things I've found about your work, and I want all of my listeners to know this, is that it's very, very readable. This book is, I'm going to check the back here. So, it's basically about 225 pages. It's a medium-sized book, and very accessible, and I love your use of stories. I think for a lot of people, hearing a story of what another person goes through and how it happens for them allows us to sort of put ourselves in their shoes and sort of imagine it more. So I like that you don't just take a distant, objective, perspective, but you bring these situations to life and make them
Thank
accessible to
you.
the reader.
Well, my first three books were only stories. They were stories about medicine, medical training, medical school, residency, medicine around the world. Because that's my most favorite thing is the medical stories. In these last two books, I've tried to interweave stories and some of the research so that, people can learn some information as well as hearing the stories.
Right. I think you're doing a great job of weaving them together.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. So one of the things that I've noticed, just there's a new clinic that I've started going to, and this is my first sort of experience with the use of computer monitors in the doctor's office. So really, up until now, every doctor that has come into my office, or whatever, what do you call it, the room, I guess I'm
Waiting
sitting.
room, an
Yeah,
exam
well,
room.
exam room. So I'm sitting in the exam room. The nurses come in, done her thing. She leaves. The doctor comes in. My doctors always come in and they either like set down a little clipboard on a counter and they sit down in a little round stool and they look me in the eye and they start chatting at me. And I think there's something about not necessarily wanting to write down with your hands, on a clipboard while you're interviewing with someone. So the clipboard is usually like put away and then they pick it up near the end and they'll start jotting down their notes. That's what I'm used to as a 44-year-old woman. Well, so I just moved to this new clinic, which has this big console with a big computer screen and a keyboard, and that's now in the room right in front of the chair. And so when I went in with my hand, which was all swollen, this was when we decided I should jump in my car and race to the ferry and head to the ER. The doctor looked at my hand for probably about 45 seconds or maybe a minute and a half, and then sat down in the chair, which was placed directly in front of the computer screen. And the next 10 minutes was staring at the computer screen and typing. And I just
Well,
sat
welcome to
there.
21st century medicine.
Okay, so what is going on to train people to understand that that is just like the clipboard and you need to focus on the patient, and then you can at the end go type your stuff down. I was really shocked, and I'm a little concerned that this might be the new direction. This is not a good direction to be going.
I mean, it is the new norm because most places are adopting electronic medical records, which have many benefits, right? We don't lose charts, we don't lose x-rays, everything is there and it's all legible. But unfortunately, the EMR, the electronic medical record, just multiplies like a fungus. Because every time you want to have some require, for example, if you want to require screening for depression, right, or asthma action plan, all of which are good things, you make another required field for the doctor to fill out. And these screens keep multiplying. Pain scores, let's say depression screening, education level, education handouts that you gave, language that you spoke, all the patient goals, doctor goals. And so they keep adding on more and more. So it takes so long to get through the EMR to finish the visit for the doctor that there's no way to get done if you don't write while you're in the visit. That's unfortunately the way it is. You can't, it just takes so long.
Well, they need to, I mean, we've all been surviving pre-computers, and doctors have been capable of giving really good care pre-computers for decades and years. So there needs to be some way of quickly
Right.
recognizing this problem, because I
Right. So
literally,
we need to
me,
improve these.
I pay attention to this stuff, and I'm just sitting
We need to
here
improve this. Right now, the
like,
system is so unwieldy.
okay.
So what can we do? So I talk about this a little bit in the book because my students and residents, they want to know how to connect with the patient. So one thing that I do is when I start the visit, I don't write anything down on the computer at all. So for example, do you know how long it takes on average for a doctor to interrupt a patient while they're talking?
To interrupt, what do you mean? How's the
Interrupt. When a
question?
patient starts talking, I'm here because my hand hurts. How long before the doctor jumps in?
I have no idea what the average is.
So the average is about 8 to 10 seconds, right? Studies show that we jump in right away. And unfortunately, as a communication strategy, it can be very dangerous because the patient may have a second thing to say, like, oh, I think I had a stroke yesterday. We may never get to that. And it's not that we're trying to be rude, but we're trying to find out, oh, when did your pain start? When did it stop? What makes it better? What makes it worse? We're trying to get the answer. But by interrupting, we often, we push the patients down one route and we never get to the other route. So my strategy is to not say a thing for the first minute. That may not sound like a long time, but 1 minute of being listened to, what I like to call full frontal listening, straight on looking, not writing, not saying a word, just listening, is actually quite a lot of time. And most patients can get their main concerns out in 1 full minute. And I think that giving that is kind of an investment in your relationship. And then I'll say, I don't want to miss what you're saying. Do you mind if I take notes while you write so I don't miss anything? And then I acknowledge the computer. I mean, the patients know it's a necessary evil and they understand that we must use it. But by spending that first minute in this really direct conversation, I don't interrupt. And so I get to hear what they have to say. And then I try to take notes while they talk so I don't, miss anything. And that's kind of my compromise
And you don't just
in.
do that, but you actually explain to them what you're doing. So you're
Right.
like,
And I
you're,
ask, do
yeah.
you mind? I ask for their, if they say, please don't, then I won't. Mostly it's fine, no problem. Then they understand why I'm looking away. We've already made a connection. And try talking to someone, time a minute of not interrupting at all. You'll see it's quite a bit of communication time, especially if you're super focused on the other person.
Well, absolutely. I couldn't really actually agree more. Thank you for phrasing it in that way. And we recently lost Dr. Weisfenning, was a longtime doctor on the island, and I was extremely lucky that I was able to spend, I think, about 6 to 9 months in his care before he retired. And I went in once with this really weird thing on my leg, and it was really fascinating the difference between the old school doctors who have been around long enough, and sometimes people who are getting caught up in this new computerized world and are struggling to figure out how to handle it. Because it was so fascinating. Of course, he didn't have a computer at that time. They hadn't shifted that way. But I'm talking about this thing on my leg, and then I just sort of stopped. I expected him to say something because I have no idea what it is. And he just, I remember, I'll never forget this. He just stood there and he looked at the leg. And he just was, I can't even pretend to do it because then the radio will freak out because I'll be silent too long. And finally, eventually, I said, "So what do you think?" And he says, "Well, anything else?" You know? And I'm like, "Oh." So he's like just silent as the grave, looking at my leg and basically creating the space that draws out of me every possible thing I could possibly come up with to say myself before he even asked the first question of his own. And everyone loved him. He was.
Well, you can see why he was probably very effective. And you know, my current interest is on medical error. It's going to be my next book, and I think a
Right.
lot of medical error comes because of these communication problems. That if we cut patients off, we don't listen carefully, or focus on something else, or trying to multitask, we will make mistakes, diagnostic errors, therapeutic errors, you know, all kinds of errors. And so I think if we're looking to minimize medical error, focusing on communication is really the most important place to be.
Well, you know what's fascinating about that experience I had when I had the hand that was turning into a balloon, and I'm sitting there watching this person who's doing all this computer stuff, and it was the second doctor I had seen at the clinic. I'd gone back 24 hours later, you know, and what he ends up telling me to do is go home and keep my hand up on a pillow and put it on a hot pack. And then he goes out of the room because he has to go do something. He's going to come back, right? So the we're not done yet, and I'm sitting there thinking, my instincts are telling me I need to be in a hospital right now. So he comes back in, and I have his attention again. I get him to look at me again. And I said, "I'm really scared, and I do not want to underrespond. Are you?" And I think I said, "Then tell me why I should go home and put my hand on a hot pad rather than going to the ER for IV antibiotics." And I said it very calmly like that. I'm not like crying, I'm not freaking out, but I wanted him, I finally had gotten his attention back to me. And he looks at me, he looks at the hand, which has red creeping down the arm, and he says, "You know, you should probably go to the ER." Now the my best guess was that, you know, he had looked at it like 15 minutes earlier for a short period of time and then went stared at the screen for 10 minutes. And then if I had been the type of patient who would just say, "Okay, I'll do what I'm told to do. You're the expert. I trust you." I would have gone home, put my hand on a hot pad, and maybe end up in the hospital for 5 days in a row with a much worse outcome because of another 24 hours at home. But instead, I respectfully engaged with him and just sort of pushed enough for him to ask himself a second time, "What do I really think should be done?" And I got the exact opposite answer of what I should do. And I couldn't help but wonder if it wasn't just that he's so distracted by apparently all these pages of things flying in his face that he maybe was a little bit underable to give the best advice the first time.
I think you're probably right, and you can see there was a medical error that was just averted by taking a little extra time. Luckily, you got it in the end, but you know, had you not, it would have been an error. And so, when we think about one way of trying to prevent diagnostic errors is when you come to a conclusion, oh, this is nothing, just a scratch thing. Is there anything else it could be? You know, am I missing cellulitis? Am I missing a fungal infection? And in the same way, having a chance to think in an undistracted way. I think our current medical system is very distracting. Our pagers are going off, phones are ringing, people are knocking on the door, there's patients waiting. It's very, very hard to think clearly and thoughtfully, about a situation. There's really no time for, prolonged and focused thought, unfortunately.
And that also, I think, going back to the original topic of the interview, falls in line with the for-profit model, which is always squeezing, 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 you know, and in other like single-payer type of systems in other countries around the world, doctors just have, they get more time with their patients.
Absolutely, and I think there's a lot. Again, it's pound penny wise, pound foolish. As we try to squeeze more patients in, we don't give doctors time to think or talk with the nurse, talk with the nutritionist about a case. We risk actually having worse quality of medical care.
Right. In fact, you had mentioned during our pre-chat that we need to rethink how we finance healthcare because you made the point, of course, that a lot of procedures and tests will be paid for by insurance companies, but that they are not as they don't pay as well for the time spent in the room talking to the patient, which could possibly avert those high expensive tests or perhaps just provide better information for better outcomes.
Sure. I mean, the way we value things in medicine is how much we're reimbursed for it. And if you put a tube in an orifice or take a scan or make a cut somewhere, the reimbursement is much higher than if you sit and talk with a patient, ask questions, probe the family history, do a careful physical exam. All that cognitive work is poorly valued, reimbursed very, you know, very low. So in order to stay afloat, doctors have to schedule many patients in. You know, that's why these visits get shorter and shorter.
Right.
But if you do a procedure or a test, then you get reimbursed.
Right. Well, I am sure there are a ton of doctors out there, given that I grew up in a medical family. My stepdad and my mom had their own practice for a while. I know for a fact that there are so many doctors out there that have been for 20 to 30 years solid, very frustrated with the impact of a failing insurance system upon their ability to give quality care. And I am sure they are very thrilled and grateful that you're doing the work you're doing.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking.
Absolutely. And I will look forward to talking to you in a year. So everyone else out there, this was my interview with Danielle Ofri. Thanks so much for joining us. My name's March Twisdale, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. Many thanks go out to Windermere Vachon, for it is their generosity that has given me the opportunity to create this show. And I'd like to thank all of you for joining me today for another hour of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, where my guests share how they hope to inspire positive change in the world, one reader and one listener at a time. And now I'll leave you with the inspirational and timely song, We Are the Many, created by musical activist Makana.
Ye come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage, to steal from us the value of our wage, from underneath the vestiture of law. The lobbyists at Washington do gnaw at liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. Our nation was built upon the right of every person to improve their plight. The laws of this republic they rewrite, and now a few own everything in sight. They own it free of liability. They own, but they are not like you and me.